This is the sixth day of this April 2010 seven-day session. We'll resume reading from the teachings of Chan Master Da Wei from the 12th century China. The book is called Swampland Flowers, The Letters and Lectures of Zen Master Da Wei. It's translated by Christopher Cleary. Here's a letter, another letter to one of his, apparently his lay disciples. Having read your letter carefully, I have come to know that you are unremitting in your conduct, that you are not carried away by the press of official duties, that in the midst of swift-flowing streams, you vigorously examine yourself. Far from being lax, your aspiration to the path grows ever more firm as time goes on. You have fulfilled my humble wishes solidly and profoundly. It's a good phrase about the all the demanding tumult of daily lives of so many of us in the midst of swift-flowing streams. Nevertheless, worldly passions are like a blazing fire. When will they ever end? Right in the midst of the hubbub, you mustn't forget the business of the bamboo chair and reed cushion. Usually, you set your mind on a still concentration point, but you must be able to use it right in the midst of the hubbub. If you have no strength amidst commotion, after all, it's as if you never made any effort in stillness. This is a point that the teachers in the Linchi line, Rinzai line, especially emphasize, is developing this temper of mind that will enable us to maintain our equanimity, our detachment in the commotion of our daily lives. It's difficult. I mean, sitting is easy compared to maintaining it throughout all of the ups and downs in daily life. But, of course, it's something that we do get better at as time goes on. Again, as I said yesterday, I think we don't stand a chance of doing that without sitting. And I would maintain sitting in the morning before you go to work or start your work. This reference to the, he says, the business of the bamboo chair and reed cushion, that's what they used for sitting in the Zendos in China. He goes on, I have heard that there was some complicated situation in the past, and now you are experiencing the sadness of the outcome. You know, that my guess is that refers to some political upheaval, the shift of winds politically, and he's run afoul of the emperor. But now you're experiencing the sadness of the outcome. Alone, you do not dare to hear your fate. If you arouse this thought, then it will obstruct the path. That is the thought of a miserable end awaiting him. An ancient master said, if you can recognize the inherent nature, While going along with the flow, there is neither joy nor sorrow. When I used to hear phrases like this, my earlier years of Zen practice, it struck me as just a little bit bleak. Not the no sorrow part, but the no joy part. But they really go along together. It's a package deal. You can't have the joy without the sorrow. In Zen, we find that what used to be a kind of giddy, very emotional, momentary joy refines itself into a much quieter, steady, deeper, more pervasive gratitude would be a good word. Gratitude is its own kind of joy. You can't do much better than feeling gratitude for everything that comes your way. But it's different than the joy he's referring to, the kind of joy of winning the lottery and then seeing your life ruined afterward. And then he quotes Vimalakirti, the great legendary Buddhist master and lay master. It's like this: the high plateau does not produce lotus flowers. It is the mire of the low swamplands that produces these flowers. This is a classic metaphor in Zen to express the value of working through really a non-monastic life. I think you could pretty much say that's what he means. All of the joys and sorrows of family life and work, working with people who have absolutely no interest in the Dharma. It's more challenging for obvious reasons, but a great strength can emerge from it. I'm not a parent, but boy, from what I hear, that's really trial by fire, being a parent. I always figure that if I keep at this the rest of my life, then I may be ready to be a parent next time around. Till then, I'll... And so this is from where the title of the book comes, The Swampland Flowers. And then he quotes the Buddha: true thusness does not keep to its own nature, but according to circumstances brings about all phenomenal things. True thusness is without features of its own, but it gives birth to all phenomena. He also said, proceeding to effect according to circumstances, it extends everywhere while always here upon this seat of enlightenment. And then Dawi says, if you consider quietude right and commotion wrong, then this is seeking the real aspect by destroying the worldly aspect, seeking nirvana, the peace of extinction, apart from birth and death. When you like the quiet and hate the hubbub, this is just the time to apply effort. Suddenly, when in the midst of hubbub, you topple the scene of quietude, that power surpasses the meditation seat and cushion by a million billion times. There's this really basic principle in Zen of accommodating the teaching to the listener, finding skillful means, a way to reach any particular student as an individual. And there's no doubt here that this recipient of this letter is someone with a lot of responsibilities, very busy life, and he doesn't have the option of entering the monastery. And so Dawi says, you find a way. You find a way, and knowing that in all the demands of worldly life, you are developing great resources. Every once in a while, someone becomes a new parent, and they may mention to me, well, it looks like it'll be quite a while before I can get to Sashin. And I can say honestly that parenthood is going to forge a great character in you, especially with if you're sitting. You can maintain the sitting when you can as a parent, but then someday, if you still want to come to Sashin, then you're going to come to Sashin. Well, you're going to bring a lot more to the Sashin in one way, and by virtue of all of the pain, let's face it, the pain of being a parent and leading a very complicated, demanding life, and enduring the slings and arrows of your teenagers. But my guess is that Dawi wouldn't be using this approach with his own monks. And to be fair, Dawi himself was never a parent and knew the advantages of monastic training. Each have their advantages and disadvantages. It comes down to, as in everything, it comes down to one's affinity, which is another word for karma. There's this saying, I think, in Christianity, man proposes, God disposes. Roshi Kaplow used to just change it to man proposes, karma disposes. So we have these ideas about what we're going to be and how our life is going to go. And sometimes it works out that way, and sometimes there are other much more profound core forces that lead us in other directions. And part of mature practice is having faith. When the die is cast, when we've become a parent, or we have taken vows to dedicate our life to the Dharma, say as a priest, then to have faith that just by following through with that commitment, you make it your karma. I used to say, before I got ordained, I struggled a bit with whether that's what I should do, and I had these two guys at the center, Casey and John Sheldon, who had already been ordained, and they were always pressuring me, some morons, when are you going to get ordained? When are you going to get ordained? And I said, very sincerely, I said, I just don't know if it's my karma. And John said something I think I still remember to this day, because I think it's so deeply insightful. He said, you make it your karma. You take vows. There, that's your karma. It's beyond our picking and choosing. Really, it is. We know that people take vows and then they change and their life changes. So it's no simple thing, whether it's getting ordained or getting married. But so much just comes down to commitment. That's why we so often recite the four vows. Roshi Kapila once said that these vows, if we recite them often enough and sincerely enough, carry through for lifetimes. This vow to liberate all sentient beings, this vow to attain the great way of Buddha. Because there's much, I don't know about this, but I sense that there's more appreciation in Asia of the power of vows and sticking with what you've vowed than there is in the United States, where so much comes down to one's feelings at any particular time and wanting to maximize one's own happiness as much as one can know that by feeling free to choose to change one's choices at any given time. It's like arranged marriages. I've read over and over that in these marriages in India, China, and a lot of traditional cultures, you don't meet your spouse until the day you're married. But then a remarkable high percentage of them say, then they fall in love after getting married. They learn to love one another because they've taken vows. And it's not so different working with a koan. You commit to it. You resolve it. Here's another letter. Once you have achieved peaceful stillness of body and mind, you must make earnest effort. This is a very important point, because often in Sesshin, people reach a point where everything suddenly settles down and a deep peace sweeps over one. And there's a real feeling of being released, feeling very free. And at such a time, in this deep quiet, which usually happens in the latter part of Sesshin, there is a temptation to just throw the koan overboard. Who needs that? My God, this is incredible, this state. But as many of you have heard from me before, and others of you have discovered yourself, you've confirmed that peace is a conditioned state. That means it changes as conditions change. It passes, in other words, without a breakthrough. Without a breakthrough, it passes. Even with a breakthrough, even getting through one's koan, the type of samadhi power that we develop, and as Sesshin moves along, this fades afterward, but it's different. It's so difficult when you reach this state of, it's a feeling of that things are resolved. It's very deceptive that way. It's a feeling that everything has come to rest. There's nowhere to go. But right then, until one has seen through this matter of birth and death, right then one must, against all of one's preferences, get a hold of that koan and just bore into it. You must make earnest effort. Do not immediately settle down in peaceful stillness. In the teachings, this is called the deep pit of liberation, much to be feared. Elsewhere it's called the pit of pseudo-emancipation, pseudo-liberation. I think it's a better term for it. Because if it's liberation, it's just a passing liberation. You must make yourself turn freely, like a gourd floating on the water, independent and free, not subject to restraints, entering purity and impurity without being obstructed or sinking down. Only then do you have a little familiarity with a school of the patch-robed monks. If you just manage to cradle the uncrying child in your arms, what's the use? Sure, it's easy to glow with a sleeping baby in your arms. A whole different matter, he's saying, when the baby wakes, and especially when the baby cries. Like a gourd floating on the water, independent and free, meaning independent of conditions, not depending on the right conditions to feel free, not subject to restraints, entering purity and impurity without being obstructed. Purity, we could understand as purity is, well, what we have in Sesshin, basically, the silence, the luxury of doing so much sitting, and then heading out into the world of strife and other kinds of challenges. Here's a letter to another person. This affair is like the bright sun in the blue sky, shining clearly, changeless, and motionless, without diminishing or increasing. He's talking, of course, about our true nature, the mind that we all have in common, this enlightened mind. It shines everywhere in the daily activities of everyone, appearing in everything. Though you try to grasp it, you cannot get it. Though you try to abandon it, it always remains. It is vast and unobstructed, utterly empty. Like a gourd floating on water, it cannot be reined in or held down. Since ancient times, when good people of the path have attained this, they've appeared and disappeared in the sea of birth and death, able to use it fully. There is no deficit or surplus. like cutting up sandalwood, each piece is it. When you cut up sandalwood, fragrant sandalwood, each piece is fragrant. You don't lose, it doesn't diminish because you cut it up. It's a wonderful passage here, this paragraph of this fundamental endowment that is common to all of us. Shines everywhere in the daily activities of everyone, not just sitting, in the daily activities of everyone. Like the bright sun in the blue sky. Regardless of how we may feel at any given time, it's always shining. He goes on, when those of power want to investigate this one great affair to the end, they all break down their facades and with bold spirit draw their spines up straight. Do not go along with the feelings of others. Take your own constant point of doubt, which means questioning the koan, and stick it on your forehead. Always be as if you owed someone millions with nothing to repay with when pressed for payment, fearful of humiliation by others. Only thus will you have some direction in the task of finding urgency where there is no urgency, getting busy where there is no pressure, and finding importance where there is no importance. Let me just pause here. Finding urgency, he means where there's no sense of urgency, where life rolls along more or less okay, no big shocks to the system, no great losses. This is a very easy way to lose sight of what really matters. Work diligently day and night, while eating and drinking, when joyful or angry, in clean places or unclean places, in family gatherings, when entertaining guests, when dealing with official business in your post. All of these are first-class times to make efforts to arouse and alert yourself and awaken. If you can manage not to forget the matter of birth and death while in the midst of the passions of the world, then even though you do not immediately smash the lacquer bucket of ignorance, nevertheless you will have planted deep the seed wisdom of transcendental knowledge. In another lifetime you will appear and save your mental power. You won't fall into evil dispositions. You overcome that sinking down into the defilement of passion. Really, he's talking about mindfulness of the koan. If you can manage not to forget the matter of birth and death while in the midst of the passions of the world, substitute mu. Whatever one's question is, here's another letter to another person. Whether you're happy or angry in quiet or noisy places, you still must bring up Jiaozhuozhimu. Above all, don't consciously await enlightenment. If you consciously await enlightenment, you're in effect saying, right now, I'm deluded. If you wait for enlightenment, clinging to delusion, though you pass through countless eons, you will still not be able to gain enlightenment. Yeah, this is one of the most deadly things in one's practice, is to have the expectation of Kensho or any thought of it. Any thought of it. It's an obstruction. Because the thought of it means that you've split into now this unenlightened state and there, then, in the future, that enlightenment state that I hope to get to. As soon as we divide the world into, or time into, enlightenment and unenlightenment, then we have consigned ourselves, at least for then, while we're thinking in those terms, as he says, we've consigned ourselves to the realm of delusion. It's sort of the very act of that thought means we are deluded at that moment. So how do we get beyond this thought of enlightenment? Well, we have a practice. That's how we get beyond it. And as stubborn as that thought may be in the mind, we can, through utter, complete absorption in the practice, get beyond it. It completely burns up. There's no such thought left. A monk asked Jiaozhou, "Does a dog have Buddha nature or not?" Jiaozhou said, "Mu." As you contemplate this, don't try to figure it out. Don't try to explain it. Don't demand clear understanding. Don't take it verbally. Don't construe the raising of it as the principle. Don't fall into empty quiescence. Don't consciously anticipate enlightenment. Don't take your understanding from the explanations of the teachers of our school. Don't drop it into the bag of unconcern. Let me just pick up on a couple of these. Most of them are pretty obvious. Well, don't try to figure out. That's one of the hardest for us to get through our thick skulls. There is this ingrained habit of thinking about it, thinking about Mu, thinking about what it is, who we are, and that's absolutely hopeless to do that. It isn't part of the realm of being figured out. Don't try to explain it. Don't demand clear understanding. This is another good point, that when we're really absorbed in our practice, things can get pretty murky. We lose our bearings. Even when the koan or the breath is clear in the mind, we still can be at sea, which is a very promising state. If we're placing ourselves in time or space, a position, then we're not we're not there. It's when we lose awareness of time and space that things are very, very promising. If you're thinking about how much more time there is left in the round, then you just have to get with it. Get more concentrated. It's a very clear signal that you're not deep enough into the practice when you're thinking about time. And then this last one, don't drop it into the bag of unconcern. One way to understand this, I'm speaking from experience, is reaching a kind of detachment where it's almost a kind of an indifference. Okay, whatever. It's one form it takes is moo is moo. There. What is moo? Well, moo is moo. It's not it. It's hard to argue with, but it's not it. He goes on, when you can keep your attention on it fully, when verbal discussion and intellectual consideration cannot reach and your heart is agitated, when it's like gnawing on an iron spike without any flavor, then you must not falter in your intent. When you get like this, it's good news. I can hear beginners saying, what do you mean it's good news when it feels like you're gnawing on an iron spike without any flavor? This is the disquiet of the doubt sensation. This is when there is sincere questioning and feeling compelled to resolve this contradiction, this dilemma. That is not a pleasant state, but it is a very potent state that precedes a breakthrough. The other extreme is just using practice as a relaxation method. It's probably better than nothing. It's probably better to be at ease than angry or causing misery to other people, but it's just, again, it's a conditioned state. Being relaxed is just a conditioned state until there's been a breakthrough. And this is what can be so misleading about the, especially late in Sesshin. There is for many people, they find their way into this state of ease and deep silence, and it is so alluring just to linger there. But there comes a point when, usually when you've been there enough times and you've then lost it later, that's when you figure out, okay, this isn't enough. It's great while it lasts, but experience shows me that it's not going to last, and I'm not going to just settle for this deep silence. And that's where the probing has to come in. Probing the koan, going beyond gatte, gatte, paragatte. Never settling, never falling into complacency. goes on, sentient beings' obstruction by evil deeds is serious. No sooner do they get out of bed each day than their minds fly around in confusion. Thinking of fame and profit, they take up the false concept of others and self, continuing unbroken like the links of a chain from morning till night, without ever growing tired of it. If perchance they think of entering our school, they think about it intellectually and immediately want to understand it themselves. People like this are beyond counting. I think it still is true that for every person who comes to a sesshin, there are 5 or 10 who never get beyond reading about Zen. And then he says to this the recipient of this letter, "But you are not this way, Shun Yuan, companion in the way. Knowing all the empty falsehoods of this defective world, with singleness of mind and intent, you want to understand where we come from when we're born and where we go to when we die, right where you are now. Since you don't know where we come from, you don't know where we go either. The clear, solitary light, present right here, the one that distinguishes right and wrong, good and bad for people, decides what is and what is not, what's true and what's false. Wait till you're like one drinking water who knows for himself whether it's cold or warm and doesn't accept the judgment in the mouth of someone else." In other words, experience this directly for yourself. "Suddenly you will burst forth and reach the ultimate peace and bliss, the place of great rest and great surcease. Then, for the first time, you give your own approval." Well, our time is up now. We'll stop and recite the 4 vows.